Okay. As this is a limited lunchtime spot, I think we'll get on, absolutely on time. I'm Christine Chinkin, the set director of the Centre for Women, Peace and Security. I know lots of you in the room, and great to meet those that I don't know. Sorry, I keep seeing eight people that I haven't said hello to yet. This is the first event of the Centre in the new term, so the first thing to say is welcome, especially to the students who've just joined the course of Women, Peace and Security, and Happy New Year to everybody. Okay, I'll keep the introduction very brief because, as I say, time is limited. But most of all, I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Dubravka Simonovic, who, is, as you all know, is the UN Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women and is also a visiting professor in practice at the Centre for the Study of Human Rights. Centre for Women, Peace and Security. There's a, I was going to say, no, you didn't, I just said it. This is a what do you call it? Flip back, deja vu, something like that. Visiting professor at the Centre on Women, Peace and Security. Get that absolutely right. Dubravka is going to talk about, essentially, her mandate, the challenges, the development, how it's unfolding. But she is extraordinarily well qualified to be talking on the issue of combating and preventing violence against women from CEDAW to Istanbul and beyond, because I think you cover all of those bases right the way through. Dubravka was a member of the CEDAW committee, that's the monitoring committee of the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, for 12 years, served in a number of positions on the committee, and brought in invaluable expertise to the work of the committee. She was then the co-chair of the committee of the Council of Europe that was responsible for the drafting of the Istanbul Convention. For those of you who don't know, the Istanbul Convention is the Council of Europe Convention on, again, preventing and combating violence against women. And I think it was due to a lot of your both diplomatic and legal expertise that we ended up with what I think many of us think is the state-of-the-art convention on violence against women. Dubravka is an academic and also a diplomat and is now, of course, the looking beyond the Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women. So, Dubravka, welcome again to the LSE. It's great to have you here, and we look forward to hearing you. And presumably, then, you're happy to take some questions and discussion at the end.
Thank you very much, Christine. Do I need to press here?
No, nothing's working. Okay.
Thank you. So let me start by thanking all of you for coming to attend this lecture and by thanking Professor Christine Chinkin and London School of Economics, Center for Women, Peace and Security for organizing this opportunity for me to present my mandate and challenges ahead. As was mentioned by Christine, this lecture will look into my mandate, current challenges, and also frameworks at the global and regional level that we have, and how to really look into current challenges and needed results in order to eliminate violence against women. With respect to this mandate is part of special procedures. And special procedures are independent human rights experts within, I will start with this presentation, and you can stop me whenever you think that you have some specific questions this is not going well. Uh-huh. Okay. So I'm seeing that we will have some problems here. Mm-hmm. Okay, maybe I should
not use it.
So sorry, you can maybe have later on a printout of this presentation, but I will not use it in order not to confuse you with respect to this presentation. So let me start with introduction of this mandate as a part of United Nations special procedures. Currently, there are 43 thematic and 14 country mandates. So this mandate on violence against women, its causes and consequences, is thematic mandate, and it was established in 1994. So many, many years ago, and at that time, violence against women was not seen as a human rights violation. At that time, at the UN, diplomats were talking about human rights issue, not about human rights violation. And establishment of this mandate by specific resolution of the, at that time, Commission of Human Rights was clear recognition that violence against women should be integrated into United Nations human rights agenda. And from that moment on, from 1994, this mandate is sending this message that violence against women is a human rights violation and should be properly integrated throughout the whole system. First special rapporteur was Ms. Radhika Kumaraswamy. She started in 1994. And her mandate was until 2003. Second one was Ms. Yakin Ertürk from 2003 to 2009. My predecessor was Rashida Manjoo from 2009 to 2015. So I started in August of 2015, and I have inherited a good framework related to the work of this mandate. I have inherited reports that were done by my predecessors, and I have inherited a position that is very challenging one, because this mandate is very comprehensive one. This mandate is allowing me to seek and receive information from different stakeholders related to violence against women, from governments, from non-governmental organizations, from United Nations agencies, from treaty bodies, from other special procedures. And also to recommend measures at global, regional, and national level that are needed to properly address and combat violence against women, its causes and consequences. I am also invited to work with other special procedures and treaty bodies in discharging this mandate. Up to now, I have seen some specific challenges related to this comprehensive mandate. And based on my assessment of the situation in my report that I have already presented to Human Rights Council, I have expressed the view that there is a need for stronger cooperation between global mechanisms like this one and regional mechanisms that are dealing with gender equality and violence against women. And for that reason, I have tried to increase cooperation with Inter-American Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women, Special Rapporteur on Rights of Women in Africa, with Working Group on Discriminatory Laws. This is another special procedure established by Human Rights Council, with CEDAW Committee, with Gravier Committee that is monitoring implementation of Istanbul Convention, and MESAWIG that is calling implementation of Belém do Pará Convention. I have also pointed out that currently at the UN level we are seeing increased cooperation between different special rapporteurs, between different special procedures. But what we are not seeing is increased cooperation between treaty bodies and special procedures. And based on what was mentioned by Professor Chinky and my long-term membership in CEDAW committee of 12 years, current work at this level as a special rapporteur on violence against women, I'm now seeing a huge need to develop better cooperation between CEDAW committee and other regional mechanisms and my mandate in order to utilize all those possibilities that are present there in terms of joint work, in terms of specific challenges for specific countries that should be addressed properly by that type of cooperation. I was invited by CEDAW committee to participate in the update on general recommendation number 19 that is dealing with violence against women, and here Women, Peace and Security Center and Professor Chinkin supported the meeting of the members of the CEDAW committee at which I was also invited. And this is now continuing as a cooperation that is ongoing, and that should continue until the elaboration of this update to General Recommendation number 19. I am also trying to focus more on crime commission, because up to now it was clear that special rapporteurs on violence against women were connected with CSW as a Commission on the Status of Women that is having meetings each year in March in New York. But links with crime commission were not developed up to now. So I have discussed that with states at the level of the Human Rights Council, and last year when resolution on my mandate was updated, it was decided that specific reference should be added to cooperation between my mandate and Crime Commission. So this is a step forward, and now I will have possibility each year also to attend the Crime Commission and to see how to really look at issues related to criminal justice and violence against women. So those are some challenges that I'm trying to pursue in order to expand results that are deemed from this mandate. I would also like to mention that at this stage of challenges, I'm trying to be very practical as a special rapporteur and to see what are those mechanisms that are giving concrete results, because we do have a lot of different reports, instruments, and already knowledge about different problems related to violence against women, but we are not clear with respect to results. What are real good practices and mechanisms that are giving clear results? And in order to focus on clear results, I have called all other global and regional mechanisms that I have already mentioned to join me, and we have jointly called all UN states. It was a joint statement published on International Day on Elimination of Violence Against Women last year, in which we have called all states to focus on current problems related to violence against women. Here I would like to mention that the aim was to have this joint call in order to send the message that all global and regional mechanisms are sharing same concerns that are present here related to obstacles and huge level and widespread and persistent violence against women and girls. We have mentioned in that statement that currently there is a lack of implementation of global and regional instruments on women's rights and violence against women, and there is a general failure to turn those rights that are rights at a global and regional level, recognized rights that are commitments, but they are not real rights at the level of homes, at the level of families, at the level of communities. They're still somewhere at the global or regional level, and they're perceived as enormous, but not, they are not turned into realities. And there are also significant gaps and shortcomings in national legislation that are dealing with violence against women. When we are looking at legislation at the national level, we are seeing different pieces and parts of laws that are addressing gender equality, violence against women, personal status, criminal justice system, and so on. But those pieces are not sufficiently interconnected, and they are not still making a good level of legal protection that is needed in order to focus and eliminate violence against women. And in general, there is also lack of reliable data on different forms of violence against women. For that reason, we have also called all states to look into full incorporation and implementation of global and regional treaties that are already there. And here we have to be clear that it is still a huge challenge. We are not yet there. Although we do have CEDAW Convention and we do have regional instruments, we do have Belém do Pará Convention, Maputo Protocol and Istanbul Convention, we do not have universal ratification of CEDAW, universal ratification of optional protocol to CEDAW, and ratification of regional treaties by regions for which they are applicable. For example, Maputo Protocol is not yet ratified by a number of African countries, 18. Belém do Pará is not ratified by all countries that should ratify. CEDAW is not ratified by 7 states. So it is a still huge problem with respect to even acceptance of those rights that are there. But if we look into incorporation of those treaties at the national level, what is happening there? Here we are seeing a huge gap, huge problem, because although countries are ratifying, although they are accepting, although they are saying those treaties are legally binding, they are not really incorporating those norms into their pieces of legislation. And in this area of violence against women, it is a challenge. You could not just say we have adopted domestic violence legislation or law on elimination of violence against women. If it is not connected with what is in a criminal law part, what is in a social services part, what is in other parts of the laws that are dealing with personal status, then it is not giving proper results. So it is a huge challenge to go through those international standards and to really turn them into legislation at the national level, but legislation that is justiciable, that is giving possibility to persons to claim their rights, to claim their protection at the national level. And another huge problem is also problem of impunity and persecution of different forms of violence against women, what is also connected with proper data. So now if I go back a little bit to my mandate, What are tools that my mandate has as a tools in order to address violence against women? First, I have possibility to use individual complaints, or individuals in different states should use individual complaints in order to complain to violence against women. And in such situations, my mandate could seek a response from different governments. And I have, through that channel that is at the beginning confidential for first period of exchange between this mandate and the state, I have possibility to use this communication as a kind of pressure, as a kind of channel to seek explanation from the government with respect to particular case. Those communications are at the end public when they are published. All special procedures do have possibility to publish those communications 3 times a year in a joint report published by a Human Rights Council. But this is not very visible because this is procedure that is not really followed by ordinary persons that are dealing, or even by NGOs that are dealing with women's rights. And if you consider number of communications that I am receiving, you will see that it is relatively low number of communications. In many cases, on different communications, my mandate is working jointly with other special rapporteurs, for example, with the special rapporteur on health, or working group on discriminatory laws, or different rapporteurs dealing with rights of children. When we have something that is common for different mandates, then we are going jointly with joint communication and we are seeking response from the government. But nevertheless, if you look at the current situation that we know that is ongoing in all countries, a number of such communications, you will see that they are not sufficiently used. They are not really utilized. And if they would be sufficiently used, then it would be a huge challenge for the system how to properly respond, because there is no such huge office there in Geneva that should support that type of work. So a central tool of my mandate are country visits. I am able to visit 2 or 3 countries per year, and these visits are based upon standing invitation that governments are that governments are offering to different special procedures. Number of governments have such standing invitations. Some of them do not have such standing invitations. And with those that do not have standing invitations, as a mandate holder, I need to negotiate possible visit. Even when there are standing invitations, when I am visiting a country, I need to have cooperation with the government when I am coming and which parts of the system I am going to visit. Up to now, 109 member states have extended this standing invitation, and this mandate had 56 official country visits, what means that for 56 countries, there are reports produced by my predecessors or by myself. When I took this mandate, I had visited first South Africa, then Georgia, then Israel and occupied Palestine territory, states of Palestine, and recently, last November, I was in Argentina. So those country visits are giving me opportunity to go to the country and to have direct discussion with officials at the level of the government, with non-governmental organizations, with independent institutions, but also to visit, for example, different provinces. If it is a federal country like Argentina with 23 different provinces, and then through such visits, it is possible to see different challenges that are not visible when you're only reading papers. Since I was in CEDAW committee for 12 years, I had many opportunities to examine countries to paperwork, because usually we have number of documents, presentation from non-governmental organizations and presentation from independent institutions, UN agencies and so on. But more or less those are papers that you're reading. Advantage of this mandate is this possibility to go to the country concerned, to have this direct contact with victims in shelters, with different government officials, with different independent institutions, and to see what are challenges there, what is properly applied with respect to international norms and where are problems. And I must admit that in all five countries that I have visited up to now, I have seen different challenges that are really opening up when you are there, when you are challenges that you are not able to see just through reports. Because, for example, for Argentina, I had a good example that I was attending the session of the CEDAW committee to discuss joint work on General Recommendation 19 on violence against women, and at the same time Argentina presented its regular periodic report. So I stayed one day longer in order to listen to the presentation of Argentina, knowing that next week I am visiting the country, and I consider that as a good opportunity to go through documents that are presented to CEDAW, and later on to have possibility as a special rapporteur to have this discussion with the government related to violence against women. And now I'm thinking that this is really good practice. Previously, I would be thinking this is duplication. Why should special rapporteur do it at the same time as a CEDAW committee? But now, after this experience, I'm seeing that this is advantage. And if we compare, for example, methodology of work by GRAVI, a committee that is following the Istanbul Convention, you will see that GRAVI has possibility to examine the country through this reporting procedure, but then also to visit the country. Members of the committee are visiting the country, and then they are producing report with recommendations. So with this experience now, I'm thinking that really combination is the best, and for that reason, this strengthened cooperation between this mandate and CEDAW in the future should be really pursued. Another tool that this mandate has is related to thematic reports. So I am reporting with respect to my visit to countries. Those are country-specific reports with recommendations. And then there are possibility for thematic reports. This mandate is invited to present reports each year to Human Rights Council, usually in June, and to General Assembly Third Committee in October. Up to now, previous special rapporteurs have published many important reports related to violence against women. And I would like to mention maybe a due diligence report published by my two predecessors, then a report on reparations related to violence against women. So there are good reports that were published, but what I'm seeing as a challenge is how to keep those reports relevant. Because sometimes we are seeing that at the UN level we have so many reports. We have many reports that are coming out, that are showing something new and relevant, but then they are forgotten. Somehow they are fading away, they are not really used, they are not living documents, instruments. And now I'm thinking that this should be changed, because if we are thinking about this area and what should be contribution of this mandate, we should think about reports that are kind of a building blocks, that are living reports that could be updated with something that is coming out as a new promising practice, some good results or good laws and so on, to have reports that are really building blocks that are alive, that should be used, and that are not something that is presented and then forgotten. For that reason, when I was looking at my priorities, and I would like to mention that for all my work, I'm very grateful to Center on Women, Peace and Security, Professor Chinkin and her team here, because I have received a lot of support from this center in terms of brainstorming, in terms of thinking about the whole mandate and challenges and topics that should be presented in my reports. So I have presented different topics, and next one on my list is related to protection and services for women survivors of violence, shelters and protection orders. And tomorrow we will have an expert working group organized by this center that will connect different experts working in this area with the aim to look into standards related to shelters and protection orders. That could be my next report, and that could be a report that is useful to states in this area. So now I'm trying to see reports as building blocks that are building this framework related to violence against women. First report presented a kind of different topics that I would like to focus on, and my second report that I have presented to General Assembly elaborated situation with respect to adequacy of international framework on violence against women. That was an interim report, and the second part of that report was related to femicide watch, or modalities how to establish a femicide watch. So very briefly on femicide watch, I would like to mention this as an initiative that is a practical one, and this report, I have tried to use what was developed up to now by different parts of the UN system. You will see that, for example, at the UN level of UN ODC and Crime Commission, each year they are producing report on homicides. But this report on homicides is not having specific data on femicides, so gender-related killings of women. You will also see that a Crime Commission adopted a resolution on gender-related killings of women, and my predecessor, Ms. Rashida Manjoo, published report on femicides. So in terms of knowing what is going on, we had those pieces of reports. But still, we didn't have mechanism how to really look into prevention of femicides. And for that reason, I have called all states to first look into data on femicides, to collect data on femicides. And this is a challenge. How to extract from homicides data on gender-related killings of women? And what are differences in different countries? And basically, the whole idea is that this part of intimate partner femicides or family-related femicides is a huge part of whole femicides that are happening in different countries. Recently, when I was in Argentina, there is now good practice by the Supreme Court. Now they are collecting data on femicides, but with some limitations because they are collecting only femicides that are at the court level that are prosecuted. So they are not addressing femicides, for example, in which perpetrator killed himself, because they are counting only data that are at the level of the court procedure. But nevertheless, from numbers that they have collected in past 2 years, it is clear that more than 70% of all femicides are family related, either intimate partner or family related. What is showing that we are really at a situation to recognize that this is a huge challenge. So this is not someone who is killing a woman at the streets. Those are family members. Those are intimate partner or family-related femicides that are not really properly prevented. And for that reason, I think that in each and every country, specific bodies, interdisciplinary bodies, either established by the government, or if there is no possibility for government to establish such bodies, it could be bodies established by NGOs or independent mechanisms like ombudspersons, they can start the process. They need to start to look into femicides and to collect data and to look into cases. And this analysis of cases, case by case, looking into specific situation of each and every woman victim of such violence, should show what was not done properly, what were mechanisms that were missed by different parts of the system that had possibly a role to prevent such femicide. And then we will see from each country how to really improve the system. So I think that now we are at the level to be practical, and the positive surprise with respect to this was that when I started to call for this femicide watch, I have seen already that in a number of countries there are some mechanisms that are comparable to this idea. So there are, for example, in United States, in Minnesota, fatality review mechanism that is doing exactly the same. They are going through specific cases. But this is not at the level of all states in United States. So it should be kind of a thing that should be done with respect to all parts of different states. In UK, there is also one NGO, Femicide Census, that is now collecting data from newspapers and other sources on a number of women killed in past 5 years. In different countries now, in Georgia, for example, ombudsperson is taking this initiative, and he started to collect data on femicides and to analyze each and every case in order to see what is happening. Recently, I had opportunity to present this idea at the OSCE, Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, who organized a symposium on femicides, and it was also clear that in a number of other countries there are initiatives that are trying now to address femicides and to push this into the direction of prevention. Now I'm speaking more than 30 minutes, so now I will try to proceed a little bit faster. And to address a little bit international framework on violence against women. So if we look at what we have now at the global level, you will see that this human rights framework that started with Universal Declaration on Human Rights and then was developed through different UN treaties in the field of human rights, you will see that this is basically a gender-neutral human rights framework. Exception was adoption of the CEDAW Convention in 1979, because CEDAW Convention is gender-specific and asymmetric. It is addressing women and girls, and it is focusing on different forms of discrimination and violence against women that is seen as a form of discrimination against women. So we are seeing that in this big UN framework, CEDAW Convention was adopted as a recognition that violence against women and discrimination against women should be specifically addressed. But now we are at the stage where it is clear that if we only apply CEDAW, it is not sufficient. CEDAW should be applied jointly with other treaties in order to mainstream CEDAW into other parts of this human rights framework. And this is happening, but very slowly. Very slowly, because there is insufficient knowledge about provisions of CEDAW, about what is really needed there, because CEDAW is a very dynamic instrument, and if you want to know what is happening each year, you have to follow up work of the CEDAW committee, different general recommendations, concluding observations, and jurisprudence coming out from the committee. And if you are not doing that, if you are just focusing on 16 articles there in the convention, you are not seeing what is happening at that level. So this issue of gender mainstreaming is very challenging for the UN system, and it is not yet at the level of recognition how to do it properly. You will see that there are many, many projects that are saying inclusion of gender perspective, proper gender mainstreaming, and so on, but at the end when we are looking at results are not there. Results are simply missing. Although there are efforts, there are efforts to include this gender perspective. And I think that the main obstacle is insufficient knowledge about the content of the CEDAW, improper application of the CEDAW. Even when I am dealing with my colleagues, other special rapporteurs that are applying other treaties, I am seeing that we do not have sufficient knowledge about each other. So we all need to exchange this type of knowledge and to know what is really meant under different parts of the CEDAW Convention. And CEDAW Convention is a very strong, very powerful convention. So it should be taught at the level of legal education in each and every country. And this is not happening. We are just expecting young lawyers to know what is there, we are expecting judges to know what is there, we are expecting judges to follow jurisprudence of the CEDAW committee, and this is not happening, simply because there is not kind of education that is needed in order really to have acceptance of this treaty as a legally binding treaty. Without that, it is legally binding only in theory, it is not really practically applied. So now if we look at this global framework, so we have global instruments, UN instruments with CEDAW convention that should gender them, and optional protocol to CEDAW was additional mechanism that enabled the committee to look into individual complaints and inquiries related to different forms of discrimination and violence against women. Then general recommendation number 19 is additional elaboration of obligations with respect to violence against women. Declaration on the elimination of violence against women is a global declaration that is not at the level of legally binding treaty, but it's very important global declaration that is working jointly with CEDAW committee in direction of explanation what are obligations related to due diligence principle, to elimination of violence against women and standards there. Then if we look at other pieces of agendas that are there, we could mention Vienna Declaration and Plan of Action from 1993 with clear recognition of women's rights as human rights, Beijing Platform for Action from 1994, and Security Council Resolution 1325. The last is SDG Agenda 1320 with very specific and very important goal number 5. And target that is specifically mentioning elimination of violence against women. And this last agenda adopted by UN member states on sustainable development is very strong for women's rights and empowerment of women. Because for the first time at this very global level, we have among 17 goals clear recognition of goal number 5, what is related to empowerment of women and achieving gender equality. And this achieving gender equality and empowerment of women is now recognized as mega goal for whole society, for whole world, in order to have sustainable development. And violence against women is specific target there, with sub-targets that are related to female genital mutilation, early and forced child marriages, and other forms of violence against women. So we do have standards. We do have standards and clear recognition of what is needed. We also have regional standards that I have briefly mentioned, among which Belém do Pará is a strong instrument at Latin American level, but also a weak instrument. I have visited their secretary, and I have seen that they have only meetings 2 times per year of 2 days, what is very limited period of time for monitoring of its implementation. Then protocol to African Charter on Women's Rights is also there, but it's not accepted by a number of African states. So this mechanism is also not fully functional, and some standards are not fully in line with CEDAW. They are even higher than standards in CEDAW. So it is an obstacle for some countries with respect to ratification. And finally, we have a Council of Europe Convention, the most comprehensive and recent convention that is dealing with violence against women and domestic violence. Here I would like to really mention extremely important work done by Professor Christine Shinkin during elaboration of this convention, because during 2 years, when ad hoc committee, CAHVIO committee, held 8 meetings on elaboration of this convention, Professor Shinkin was scientific expert. She was sitting there, and she was responding to different questions posed by delegates related to global and regional standards, jurisprudence, everything that was under discussion during elaboration of this convention. And this convention is currently the latest state of art instrument that is reflecting what is needed in order to combat and prevent violence against women. Being able to be there during that time and to look how this convention was developed and what were key challenges. Now I am trying to, from this perspective, to send a message that CEDAW Convention and Istanbul Convention are complementing each other, and that basically all obligations from Istanbul Convention are already in a CEDAW Convention. They are on a more abstract and a more global level. So those, for example, Council of Europe member states that have not yet ratified the Istanbul Convention, they do have all those obligations under the CEDAW, but the road is not so clear like road provided by the Istanbul Convention, because with detailed provisions related, for example, to shelters, to protection orders, provisions that are not in CEDAW Convention, but are in CEDAW recommendations, in CEDAW recommendations related to concluding observations to individual countries or jurisprudence. So you will see them kind of present in different kind of soft law produced by CEDAW committee, and on the other hand you will see legally binding treaty that is giving a roadmap to states how to apply those obligations there. So I think that this is a huge advantage, and ratification of Istanbul Convention should be seen as a step into proper and better implementation of CEDAW Convention also. Unfortunately, we are seeing that there are some misunderstandings currently with respect to ratification of Istanbul Convention coming from a number of Eastern European states, in which they are claiming that definition of gender is something that was not done before, and this is seen as an obstacle for ratification of this convention. And they are not considering that the similar explanation of or definition of gender is contained in General Recommendation Number 25 coming from CEDAW Committee. So this is not a real obstacle for implementation of Istanbul Convention. Advantage of Istanbul Convention is also that there are specific and clear provisions related to shelters, related to protection orders, related to a comprehensive approach and coordination mechanisms needed to address violence against women. Difference within the scope is that Istanbul is addressing violence against women and then expanding to elimination of discrimination against women, to which it is contributing to elimination of violence against women. And some articles from Istanbul are mirroring articles from CEDAW Convention. For example, this obligation to embody principle on equality between women and men, to repeal discriminatory laws, some articles related to special measures that are not deemed as discriminatory, they are contained in both conventions. So we are seeing that Istanbul is now very good detailed elaboration of obligations that are present at the global level. When I have visited Israel, I have discussed with them their current efforts to ratify the Istanbul Convention. So now they're using the Istanbul Convention as a framework to put their laws in line with provisions in Istanbul, and they are trying to proceed with ratification of the Istanbul Convention. So this is posing a question. So how should we see now this international global framework related to violence against women? Do we need to change it? Do we need to have something as Istanbul Convention at the global level? Or do we need to look into implementation of CEDAW and regional mechanisms that we already have? Those questions are currently under discussion, and I hope that with good inputs coming from academic institutions, coming from global and regional mechanisms that are dealing with implementation of current treaties, we will be able in forthcoming years to find a right solution. Personally, when I'm thinking what is still needed, I'm having idea that maybe we need to call for Fifth World Women's Conference. Last Fourth World Women's Conference was in 95. And from that time on, each 5 years at the level of the UN, there is a so-called review of what was achieved with respect to implementation of the Beijing Platform for Action. And there is always argument and fear that we should not reopen Beijing, so we do not need Fifth World Women's Conference. And I think that this is basically wrong, because we are having conferences on all other issues, and we are not properly assessing where we are in terms of women's rights and violence against women. So we should maybe call it implementation conference. We should call it implementation conference in order to see what is currently happening at different parts of the world, with preparatory conferences at different regions like we had before the Beijing, in order to see where we are and what is still needed. In that effort, the proper assessment of role of global and regional mechanisms, international framework, and everything could be done in order really to see how to proceed faster. Because what we are now seeing is that we do have plenty of instruments, we are not using them properly. We do have mechanisms, we are not using them properly. We do have possibility to improve many, many tools that we have, but we are not having financial resources. So we do have many challenges in front of us, and we do not have clear course of action. So I think that now we are at a stage where we really need to address what is still needed, and I hope that all of you, through your work, can contribute to this effort, that you as a young forces that are seeing things differently, that are seeing things from a, let's say, your young perspective, could push things in right direction. Thank you.
Thank you. I think you've showed us the complexity of the institutions, the vastness of your mandate, and the complexity of finding practical and workable solutions and the political will to implement them. I might just add to the plea for ratification of the Istanbul Convention, the UK government, which is still, despite a commitment by Cameron made, now Lisa will remind me, 4 years ago, was it Lisa?
Four
years ago, and that they would ratify it, they have still failed to do so. So it's not just Eastern European countries. Okay, we've got about 10 minutes. So some very brief questions. I'll take two or three and see if Dubravka can reply to them sort of quickly. So here, can you just say briefly who you are? Oh, Bella. I didn't realise it was you.
My name's Bella and I'm a visiting fellow here at the centre. Thank you very much, Dr. Simonovic. I just want to draw a couple of the things that you talked about, bring them together in this question. You talked about political will, you want to be practical, you talked about cooperation, and then you highlighted some of the challenges to gender mainstreaming in the UN. Given that we have a new Secretary General, my question to you is, do you think there is scope for example, you to engage with the Security Council so that, frankly, they can actually better understand the underlying gendered causes of violence and violent conflict? Because, as you know, they focus on immediate, but is there some scope in terms of your cooperation that you could really be engaging with them on a regular basis, at least to educate, inform, discuss? Thank you.
Okay, another question? Who else would like to? Gosh, very cool. Yes.
Hi, I'm Anthe from the Gender Institute. I'm just interested in how you navigate the issues related to cultural relativism. When you're making visits to countries, do you get resistance on grounds of cultural practices? And I'm hoping you can talk about that, and if so, how you might navigate that.
Is there a third question? And both of those, yeah, I'll just take the one more and then just, yeah.
Hi, my name's, Victoria Barnes from the Human Dignity Trust. My question focuses on the violence that's actually experienced by lesbian and bisexual women, particularly those that are in countries that still criminalise same-sex sexual intimacy. And really, in your role, how you can use the application of an intersectional approach to actually deal with the specific harms that lesbian bisexual women face, which is in a different way to other women because of their gender and the way it intersects with their sexual orientation. So I wonder if you could address anything you're doing in your mandate to focus on that work.
Three demanding questions.
Thank you. I would need another 45 minutes. with respect to Security Council, this is a very, very challenging questions. Up to now, Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women never addressed the Security Council. So I think that this is a challenge, and how to address the challenge is also very important question for my mandate, because we have to see what is present there in terms of framework when we are dealing with Security Council, and basically it is Security Council Resolution 1325. What I'm seeing from perspective of my mandate is that it is huge advantage to have such resolution, but this resolution 1325 should use jointly with bigger framework, with CEDAW Convention and other documents that are dealing with women's rights. And what I'm seeing is that countries are exclusively at Security Council using only 1325. So there is in this connection between general global agenda and specific security, women, peace and security agenda. And this is also reflected to my mandate. So, for example, Bangura mandate that is established by Secretary General, but that is the part of the system, is perceived as a part of the system that is dealing with sexual violence in a conflict. And there is no sufficient recognition that that mandate is part of the system. So she is, as a mandate, not at the level of this independent mandate. What means that my mandate is I could not be, for example, changed by decision of the Secretary General. I am appointed by states at the level of Human Rights Council for a period of 3 and possibly extension to 6 years. All and other persons that are appointed by Secretary General, they are kind of part of the system. They have offices, they have salaries, and so on. So there are differences. And now how to send the message that this mandate is a global one that should kind of address issues related to women, peace, and security is a challenge. And I think that there is a room for improvement, because all those examples of sexual violence committed by peacekeeping forces are not properly addressed by the system. So I think that maybe independent mechanisms like this mechanism and some others could do a better job there. But still, this is a challenge, how to do it. And maybe new Secretary General will look into different mechanisms that are there and see how to combine their mandates better in terms of really looking at results. So I hope that this is a possible line of development in the future. We are not yet there, but thank you for this question. With respect to cultural relativism and arguments coming from different states related to preservation of their cultures and traditions, it is very present. It is there, and it is happening during all my visits to different countries. You are seeing from different government officials that they are claiming that those cultural sensitivities are extremely important, they should be preserved, and so on. And in the same time, they do not have sufficient knowledge about global and regional mechanisms. So there is a huge need for education in this area of women's rights as human rights, and recognition of possibility to reconcile these cultural issues with global norms. Recently, I was in a conference in Abu Dhabi, organized by United Arab Emirates, and at the beginning of this conference, it was a religious leader, Imam, who presented his view about the position of women in Islam. And he was so progressive. It was such a good presentation that I would put him on a CNN to go each day for a few minutes. Because you are not usually listening such progressive interpretation with respect to religion and position of women in Islam and so on. So I think that we need to find those individuals that are sending those messages, that are really seeing women's rights as compatible with different current practices, that should be updated and changed. And I think that we are also not yet there, because in many countries human rights are not yet perceived as a something that is providing benefits for all. They're perceived in many countries, you can see, those are Western rights just imposed on African countries or other countries and so on. They are not really preserving our traditions and so on. And then, in addition to this, there are different wrong beliefs that were developed through a number of years that could be easily changed but are not changed because we do not have proper tools and proper education for such communities. And this is happening, for example, with respect to FGM. If you look at prevalence of FGM and what is still happening, I think that we all feel frustration because progress is very slow and progress is uneven. But there are good practices, and I would like to mention some practices developed by UNICEF in area of changing social perception of FGM, because, for example, I'm a lawyer, and usually lawyers think we need to change the law, it should be prohibited, full stop. But then it is not sufficient. Even if you change the law, you have to see that those practitioners are still doing that type of job. They are even supported by government, they have prohibited FGM and so on. And there are beliefs around that practice that this is for the benefit of a daughter in a family. And in order to change that belief, it is important to have education of grandmothers, education of fathers and mothers, how to avoid this harmful practice and what is behind that practice. And this is a process related to education that is not provided, that is not yet there. So I think that this is the failure of Western European countries that are providing development assistance to countries with such practices, but not in a proper manner. So it is a huge challenge. Then third question you're
very
having.
Very quickly,
yeah. Okay. Intersectional discrimination and discrimination against lesbians and women that are or different gender identities. It is very important that now we have new special rapporteur that is dealing with those issues at the level of the Human Rights Council. What was achievement in terms of development of mechanisms and standards? But on the other hand, there is present huge opposition in a number of countries that are not really recognizing such rights as human rights. And this is also connected with level of education and development in such countries. And you will see that basically they are claiming, even those that are, let's say, progressive, they are claiming that those topics are also Western European topics that are pushed as priorities, and they do have different priorities at the national level and not priorities related only to LGBTI community. So I think that international community should be consistent and persistent and sensitive on these issues. So integration of LGBTI rights into human rights agenda is very important achievement. But in the same time, when countries that are having wrong perceptions about those rights, they need to have a recognition of their problems in terms of different areas of human rights and integration of LGBTI rights in the whole agenda. I think that we should not push separately only for one set of rights. I think that we have to put rights of all persons in a proper context in order to move those communities forward. Because in this area, it is not a progress if you have just one person moving in right direction. It is a challenge how to move the whole community, how to change the whole way of thinking, how to change this perception. And this is something that should be properly addressed. Beginning is what was done by recognition of need for special rapporteur on LGBTI persons. But this is also this was voted. It was done with strong opposition. Now it is a challenge for this special rapporteur, and I hope that all other special rapporteurs will support him in his role to have a message that this is a piece of human rights agenda that should be jointly integrated and applied by all states. So I think that you're right, it is a challenge, and my mandate is trying to support this direction.
We really are out of time. So thank you very much again, Dubravka. I think you've covered an enormous amount of ground, but it's indicated just how much there is still to follow. So thank you. Can you thank Dubravka again? Thank you.